Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from the March 25th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And this week we're going to start with why we overspend. The rise of frictionless payments makes it easy to keep buying, whether we can afford it or not. And this is by Elena Semuels. My credit card is a mangled thing. Its blue plastic backing is peeling so much that it doesn't work in swipe machines. It looks like a dog chewed it up and spit it out. It seldom leaves my wallet anymore, but that doesn't matter. In the 2 weeks before writing this story, I spent more than $4,000 on my card without laying eyes on it. Each of these transactions was made online, where my credit card number is stored. That's probably why I didn't flinch when I spent $333 on groceries for a weekend with friends, $48.34 on a pizza through Uber Eats, or even $1,533 for an Airbnb when my extended family came to visit. Without having to type my card number in, the purchase seemed less significant. Frictionless transactions are common in today's economy. You can wave your cell near a cash register, press buy on Amazon without really knowing which credit card you're charging, and send money to a stranger via your phone without having met them in person. There's even a company marketing a ring you can use to pay for things. These technologies, often referred to as FinTech for financial technology, make spending easier than ever before, and there's growing evidence that they're making us shell out more than we realize. With so many different accounts to keep track of and so many merchants debiting what we owe every month, we just keep on buying, whether we can afford it or not. U.S. consumers spend a record $19 trillion in January of 2024, which was up 4% from a year ago and 29% from January of 2020. Spending has soared despite inflation, high interest rates, and repeated commentary from economists that the exuberance cannot continue, and yet it has. There's so many reasons why people are spending so much right now. Consumers saved a lot of money when they were stuck at home during the pandemic, and now they're making up for lost time by traveling, eating out, and doing all the things that they could not during the quarantine. The government helped people feel flush by sending out stimulus checks and pausing student loan payments. After years of slow wage increases, workers' payments are finally growing more quickly than the prices, giving them extra pocket money. But there's one additional factor that has changed since the beginning of the pandemic. People are more accustomed to using financial technology to pay for things, which eliminates barriers that once might have slowed their spending. Convenience makes it easier to enjoy the process of shopping, removing the additional difficulties of buying things, says Yuquan Zhu, a professor at the University of North Carolina's Kenan Flagler Business School, who has studied frictionless payment methods. Research shows that more frictionless the payment method, the more money people will spend. By 2023, according to the McKinsey survey, 73% of consumers had paid for something through a browser on their phone or their computer, up from 46% in 2019. People are also more comfortable using mobile payment apps like Apple Pay, Google Pay, PayPal, and Venmo. More than 53% of Americans surveyed by Forbes Advisor last year said they use digital wallets more often than traditional payment methods. Paying with a mobile phone is faster than using a credit card. It takes an average of 29 seconds versus 40 seconds, and that's according to Zhu. That speed and convenience accelerates the spending. Zhu and her colleagues found in a study that tracked spending after the Chinese launch of Alipay, a mobile payment service. The study found that the amount spent in credit card transactions increased by 9.4% and frequency of transactions by 10.7%. It's not so much a matter of loosening the purse strings as doing away with them altogether. Once consumers started using mobile payments, they became more comfortable with making credit card payments on their computers and started moving more money digitally. And once they were comfortable spending money digitally, they started spending more money overall. Elizabeth Mendoza, a 33-year-old who lives in Washington State, says she was getting her debt under control before the pandemic by setting aside cash twice a month for various budget categories like groceries, gas, or pet care. She found that she spent less using cash because she would think twice about parting with a large bill. But once COVID-19 hit, Mendoza got into the habit of buying things online and saving her credit card information in different apps. Soon, she found herself back in about $20,000 worth of debt. "Once I stopped using my cash," she said, "I stopped paying attention to what I was doing." Last October, Mendoza vowed to get out of debt and removed her credit card from any app that would save it, including Apple Pay. She now stashes her cash in colorful envelopes every month to make the process more fun. Buying stuff online is more of a hassle now since she has to go find her wallet and type in her information. But she says it's made a huge difference in her spending. It's just so easy to fall into the use of your credit card and not keep track of what is actually going on, she says. Economists refer to the way people organize and spend their money as mental accounting. Humans are often irrational with the way they choose to spend and save money, splurging with a $100 bill found on the sidewalk while fastidiously saving every penny of their salary, for instance, or even spending more money on the same item if they're paying via credit card than if they use cash. Mental accounting is a big reason people spend more with frictionless payments. Consumers think of new apps like Buy Now, Pay Later or Apple Pay as a separate budget category that enables new spending, says Michael Gelman, a finance professor at the University of Delaware. In an experiment, Gelman tracked the behavior of consumers who had received a random credit card in the mail. While those consumers' spending behavior on their odd credit cards remained the same, they started to splurge on the new one, dropping 26% more than people who had not received a new card. "Once you open a new budget category, you manage it separately," he says. "It can have an effect on total consumption. You consume more because you have the opportunity." Yanabel Colon, a 35-year-old account manager in the Bronx, was once that type of person who would buy things with cash and use her credit cards for emergencies. But cooped up at home during the pandemic, she started putting more things on her credit card and used Buy Now, Pay Later services. She mentally categorized Buy Now, Pay Later spending as cash, which got her into trouble. She says, "I was like, well, it's not a credit card. I don't have to make payments," she said. Now she sets a budget every month for certain categories like food and doesn't exceed them, no matter how she is paying. Strong consumer spending has helped stimulate the economy and provided healthy profits for companies that depend on the American consumer. Walmart saw online sales grow 17% in the last quarter and made about $1.2 million a minute in 2023. Amazon recently reported its highest operating profit in history. But many American consumers are spending beyond their means. Household debt reached a record $17.5 trillion in the fourth quarter of 2023, surging $3.4 trillion since the end of 2019, and that's according to the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. Credit card debt has passed a milestone, says Michelle Ranieri, vice president and head of the U.S. research and consulting firm over at TransUnion. Card balances now stand at $1.05 trillion, 13% higher than a year ago. The percentage of credit card balances that are 90 days or more delinquent ticked up in the last quarter of 2023, and that's according to the New York Fed, reaching nearly 10%. Credit counselors say the rise in debt is related to the difficulty many face in keeping track of their spending. The proliferation of fintech like Apple Pay and Buy Now, Pay Later creates this scattered universe of different payment options that can lead to overspending and financial instability. And that's according to Bruce McClary, Senior Vice President at the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, or the NFCC, which is the largest nonprofit financial counseling organization in the United States. It's hard to track all of the spending because many of the apps that help people do so have disappeared in recent years. Mint, the personal finance app, which will be shutting down on March 23rd, according to Intuit, the company that owns it. And there aren't many good free options left. But there are a few ways that credit counselors say people can combat overspending on frictionless transactions. Jessica Spangler, a money educator whose book Invest Like a Girl comes out on March 26th, tells people to set up their phones so that they can get a notification every time they make a purchase, no matter what payment method they use. That way, Spangler says, you're not just swiping into the void. The NFCC's McCleary recommends having only a few accounts where you spend money so that you can track them. It's easy, he says, to set up new accounts and forget that they charge your credit card, which makes it harder to calculate whether you're overspending. As for me, I've started putting reminders on my calendar to check my credit card balances so I can track how my spending on the apps is piling up. Not that it's easy. Digital payments are swift. But the process of logging into my account to track them is a headache that involves remembering bank passwords and logins, and then waiting for the bank to send me a code to verify my identity. If spending money were as hard as tracking it, we might not do so much of it. Now let's head over to the brief. It's Trump's party, and this is by Eric Cortalesa. The MAGA movement's takeover of the GOP is now complete. Every 4 years, Super Tuesday makes for high drama, as voters in roughly a dozen states winnow down the presidential field. This time, it's only confirmed what seemed obvious for months. The Republican primary was over. With a series of smashing victories, Donald Trump had effectively clinched the nomination. His last remaining opponent, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, suspended her campaign the next morning. While she didn't endorse Trump, most of the party was already falling in line behind him. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason, Trump told supporters in a victory speech at Mar-a-Lago. This is a big one. Trump's triumph gets him another step closer to reclaiming the presidency and pursuing a draconian policy agenda unlike any nation has ever seen. He has vowed to round up and deport millions of undocumented immigrants, reimpose his travel ban on the Muslim-majority countries, purge the federal bureaucracy of civil servants, and replace them with MAGA loyalists, force the homeless Americans off the street and into tent cities, and commandeer the Justice Department to exact revenge on his political enemies. He also grows closer to squashing two of the four criminal prosecutions against him. As president, he could shut down his federal indictments, one for election interference and another for mishandling the nation's secrets. When Trump left office in January of 2021, after unleashing a mob on the U.S. Capitol, few foresaw him engineering a one-sided victory 3 years later in one of the least competitive open primaries in U.S. history. But Trump and his allies did. They had a plan, from the start, to kneecap the heretics and scare off the potential challengers. Their success was never inevitable. When Trump launched his candidacy in November of 2022, he was under a dark cloud. Republicans had just suffered a disappointing midterm cycle, with many of his hand-picked candidates losing critical races. The party's own top brass saw it as a sign to move on from the former president. Not a single member of Congress attended the Trump campaign kickoff at Mar-a-Lago. Trump's foremost priority was to neuter the man many presumed to be his most formidable intra-party threat, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who had just won a landslide re-election. Trump quickly went to work, debasing him with nicknames like Meatball Ron and Tiny D, dispatching a brigade of online trolls to mock his campaign missteps and racking up endorsements from Florida's congressional delegation. The attacks not only undermined DeSantis' attempt to pitch himself as a more competent version of Trump. They also sent a message to the would-be rivals: be prepared to face the career-destroying wrath of a MAGA onslaught. His campaign was actually revived by the indictments, which Trump framed as an attack on his supporters. The maneuver enabled him to rise in the polls and raise millions with each new charge. At the same time, he cunningly used his ordeal to box in his GOP adversaries with a catch-22. If they claimed he couldn't win the White House because of his legal woes, he categorized them as a part of a conspiracy to derail his candidacy. Yet, if they defended him, as most did, they only amplified and corroborated his central argument with Republican voters. From then on, Trump barely had to make an effort. He faced a weak field of rivals who were too timid to attack his greatest vulnerabilities. When Trump skipped every primary debate, he made the events seem like they were auditions to be his running mate. By the time Nikki Haley took the gloves off, she had already lost in Iowa and New Hampshire and seemed to be mounting more of a symbolic anti-Trump mission than a serious presidential bid. But as she hung on, Trump and his allies branded her as a warmongering neocon, even though her primary foreign policy experience was as Trump's envoy to the United Nations, and set out to humiliate her. In her home state of South Carolina, Trump won by 20 points. After Haley secured her first primary win in Washington, D.C., the Trump campaign called her the Queen of the Swamp. Even before Haley formally dropped out, Trump had already signaled a turn to the general election. He proposed a revamp of the Republican National Committee, installing new loyalists to lead the organization, and narrowed his attacks on President Joe Biden. The only remaining question was whether Haley would try to unite her supporters around Trump. Sources say she doesn't plan to endorse her former boss. None of that seemed to be on Trump's mind at the end of Super Tuesday, or at least he wasn't showing it. He never mentioned Haley's name in his victory speech. Instead, he focused on the last man standing in the way of his return to power. "We've watched our country take a great beating over the last 3 years," Trump said. "We're going to take back our country." Now let's head over to the bulletin. Spring won't bring Gaza relief. The war in Gaza is entering its sixth month and its third season. More than 30,000 people have been killed since the Israeli offensive answering Hamas's October 7th massacre, and some 1.9 million displaced people have endured homelessness in punishing winter weather, marked by heavy rain and low temperatures. And while many may greet the arrival of spring as a reprieve from the cold, experts warn that the higher temperatures come with their own set of challenges, one that stand to make the situation in Gaza even worse. First, we have disease threat. Higher temperatures, besides bringing relief from the cold, can accelerate the spread of communicable diseases, such as diarrhea and hepatitis A. It's the perfect environment for a massive epidemic to take hold, warns Francisco Cecchi, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who specializes in disease control in crisis. Among Cecchi's top concerns is the warmer weather, which could lead to a cholera outbreak, noting that Gaza's decimated healthcare system does not have the resources to cope with illnesses that require extensive rehydration. Second, we have malnutrition. Perhaps the most acute crisis is the dire shortfall of food and other humanitarian aid entering the Strip, conditions the United Nations and others have warned will make famine almost inevitable. Fazia Alvi, a Canadian physician who recently returned from a medical trip to Gaza, told Time magazine that she witnessed children who had symptoms of severe malnutrition, including some who she believes were suffering from rickets, a condition that often stems from dietary deficiencies. She also saw fungal infections and hepatitis A, the spread of which she attributed to widespread overcrowding. The children and the adult who escaped their bombing and sniper shots, they will die from disease. And lastly, we have predicted deaths. The situation continues to deteriorate day by day, according to the International Rescue Committee. noting that only a swift and lasting ceasefire would allow the level of aid that the people of Gaza so urgently need to survive. In a recent study, Chechi and his co-authors projected that even in the absence of epidemics, an additional 58,260 Palestinians will be killed over the next 6 months if things remain unchanged. That figure jumps to 74,290 in the event of an escalation. The way things are heading right now is consistent with our worst scenario, says Chechi, perhaps even a little bit worse than that. Next we have Good Question. Why are users upset about Reddit's IPO? And this is by Andrew R. Chow. Reddit users can move markets. 3 years ago, members of the finance-focused subreddit r/WallStreetBets, one of the platform's biggest communities, banded together to push GameStop's stock price upward in unprecedented ways. Now Reddit itself is hoping to tap into its users' unruly energy by allowing them to participate in the company's IPO. Reddit filed to go public on February 22nd, seeking a valuation of at least $5 billion. Crucially, the company said it would set aside a large number of shares for 75,000 of the company's most prolific users, who might be able to profit off the company's financial success. But rather than galvanizing the community, the news was met with fierce backlash and pessimism from many Redditors, who cast doubt on the company's business model, complained about recent changes to the site, and ironically threatened to wield their collective power to bet against the company's stock. The overwhelming negativity from Reddit's own community illuminates a fundamental problem with social media, where business models are often at odds with the people platforms ostensibly serving. Reddit is one of the most visited websites in the United States, with 73.1 million daily active users. But the company is still unprofitable. While it grew 21% in revenue last year, it also lost more than $90 million. Compared with Instagram, X, and other social media platforms, Reddit has especially struggled to monetize its audience through ads, partly because its content is generally more freewheeling and untamed than that of its counterparts. Reddit is powered by users who post content and moderate the site mostly for free. And while Redditors tend to be intensely devoted to their subreddits, the subject-specific forums that make up the platform, many have grown increasingly disillusioned with the platform overall. Last summer, hundreds of Reddit communities engaged in its widespread blackout to protest price changes for third-party app developers. When Reddit goes public, likely in the next couple of months, it'll be for the first major tech IPO of 2024 and the first social media IPO since Pinterest's in 2019. Very few companies have taken this route recently because of a turbulent stock market and high interest prices. As Reddit woes traditional high-profile investors, it also establishes a directed shares program, which lets the most active Redditors buy into the IPO early. But the announcement did not have the intended effect. Redditors responded with disdain, accusing the company of prioritizing the profits at their expense. "They're trying to trick us into buying their stock to pump up the price," wrote one user. Another compared the program to a company throwing a pizza party for its workers, then forcing them to buy the pizza. A spokesperson for Reddit did not respond to a request for comment. r/WallStreetBets looms large over the IPO. If those users get involved, they hold the collective power to move the company's stock price in unpredictable ways. Reddit even acknowledged this in its filing, writing that the participation of Redditors could result in increased volatility. So far, r/WallStreetBets has not taken kindly to the idea. Many of them actually threatened to short Reddit's stock to bet on its failure. In particular, they complained about the vast difference between the compensation of Reddit CEO Steve Huffman, who received more than $193 million in 2023, including stock and option awards, and add a volunteer moderators who do the heavy lifting of the organizing and overseeing of the site's communities while making nothing. However, some super users retain faith in the company. One who said his name was Kevon, but still asked to be remaining anonymous over concern about his job and his personal life, wrote to Time magazine that he planned to buy shares in the IPO, believing that the current negative sentiment was more of a product of Reddit's tendency to devolve into hive mind as opposed to wielding expertise or insight. Every year, there are comments that the site or company are going downhill from what it used to be, he wrote, yet it continues to grow at a rapid pace. And I think we have time for one more. Burned. Texas's scorched panhandle. A million acres swept by fire. The Smokehouse Creek fire was named for the place it began on February 26th, the grasslands lining a tributary to the Canadian River north of Amarillo, Texas. But within days, dry winds had blown it into the second largest wildfire in U.S. history, a galloping, aptly named conflagration that by March 6 had burned 1.1 million acres and caused the deaths of two people, an 83-year-old woman who was found in her burned home and a 44-year-old woman who died after being found outside her truck that had been overtaken by the smoke and the flames. Three other wildfires, the Windy Deuce, the Magenta, and the Grapevine Creek, also raged into the first week of March, taking in the first few days nearly half as many acres as the wildfires had burned across the entire nation in all of 2023. As of March 7th, only the Magenta had been contained. In neighboring Oklahoma, multiple fires burned more than 300,000 acres. Evacuations were ordered across the region, and at least 500 structures were destroyed. But in cattle country, most of the losses were animals. Thousands of heads were lost among the millions that grazed the grasslands that had grown especially tall over the past year. Republican Governor Greg Abbott issued a state disaster declaration in 60 Texas counties. On the other end of the state, President Biden paid tribute to the first responders during a visit to the border at Brownsville. "When disaster strikes, there's no red state or blue state where I come from," he said. "There are just communities and families looking for help." He noted that Texas had received $13 billion in relief funding under his presidency, and that the frequency of disasters flowing from extreme weather has ticked up sharply. "I love some of my Neanderthal friends who still think there's no climate change," he said. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from Time Magazine, the March 25th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.